Good afternoon, and welcome to the Ashmolean Museum. For those I don't know, my name is Christopher Brown. I'm the director of the museum, and I'm very pleased that this academic conference is beginning here at the Ashmolean. The four talks we're to hear this afternoon introduce a three-day academic conference at Jesus College, Proto-Globalization in the Indian Ocean World, Multidisciplinary Perspectives. And the conference will explore two immense questions. It simply says here large, but they are immense, I think. How connected or globalized was the old world at the period 2000 BC to 1000 AD? Question mark. And how did ancient globalization differ from or shape present-day globalization? It seems to me, and I hope you agree, that the Ashmolean is the perfect location to start asking such questions. We have, of course, a universal museum here, global in reach, and organized in its new manifestation, which we opened exactly 4 years ago tomorrow, around the theme of crossing cultures, crossing time. The collections here at the Ashmolean speak about connections between cultures very much more than their differences. The museum therefore sits at the centre of such scholarly debates, and therefore I particularly welcome you this afternoon. The Ashmolean has a long tradition of using its objects for teaching in the traditional subjects, classics, art history, archaeology, but now recently we've started the University Engagement Programme, which is funded by the Mellon Foundation very generously, and it's actively promoting access to the collections, the stories they tell, the questions they raise throughout the university. So we're encouraging our colleagues elsewhere in the university to use these collections to teach from the collections of material culture in a way that really hasn't been done up until now, as much as I would like to happen. So we're actually developing the teaching uses of the collections here very, very actively indeed under the terms of the University Engagement Programme. And so not just those traditional faculties that you might imagine would do this, classics, art history, archaeology, but also, of course, faculties as diverse as medicine, business, law, so throughout the university. And the size of the audience we have here this afternoon clearly demonstrates how the museum serves to bring such academic study and public interest together as nowhere else, is something of which we're enormously proud. So thank you for listening to my few introductory remarks. I'm now going to hand over to my colleague, Paul Collins, who we stole not so long ago from the British Museum, and who looks after our Near Eastern collections and who will introduce this afternoon's lectures. Paul.
Well, thank you very much, Christopher, and allow me to echo his welcome to the Ashmolean to all. Just a few words of housekeeping, since I'll be chairing this session and introducing the different speakers. The talks this evening will be recorded, so if you have a mobile phone, I ask you to turn it off. And if you have left your coat on one of the racks to the side, or you've left your bag there, those will be moved by our very efficient events team to the exit of the museum, so you don't need to worry about them. They won't have gone missing. They will be securely transferred to the exit for your departure after this evening's reception. So, to begin proceedings, we'll explore a range of topics over the next hour or so, and our first speaker, of very four distinguished archaeologists who are here this afternoon, is Himanshu Prabha Ray. Dr. Ray has been the head of the National Monuments Authority of the Ministry of Culture of the Government of India since 2012. As many of you will know, she is an expert in the very early periods of Indian history, stretching up to the 7th century AD. Wide-ranging interests economic exchange between South Asia and neighbouring regions, maritime archaeology of South and Southeast Asia, and the influence of colonial attitudes and bias on the historiography of South Asia, and particularly the interpretation of archaeological findings relating to Buddhism in the region. And it's on that last topic that we welcome her this afternoon to talk about travelling with the Buddha.
Contacts around there. a Buddhist, on a railing surrounding a Buddhist tomb. And there's an inscription there, which is 100 BCE, which talks about the merchants who have been saved from being devoured by this monster. And what is interesting is the term that is used, Mahadev, which is a term which is used for the Buddha, but is comes from a Chinese account. So there are no straightforward readings, and I think one has to factor in several issues here: translations, textual sources, the relationship of textual sources with the sculptural representations, and the narratives themselves, the choice of narratives and who was making these narratives. The site is nowhere close to the sea. It's in central India. It's a site which was discovered in 1873. There have been several excavations there. And several explorations more recently. Much of the material from this site, which is true of 19th century archaeology, was moved to the Indian Museum in Calcutta. And so there's very little at the site, but most of it is in Calcutta. That's to give you an example of the site as it was when it was first excavated in the 19th century. That's the stoop and the railing, but the entire railing is in the museum and not at the site. What is also quite interesting is the conceptualization of this monster, these monsters which devoured boats and devoured merchants and formed dangers in the maritime world of the Indian Ocean. It's not just sculptural representations, but there are also accounts and descriptions of these in Greek sources. So my question is, what do we make of this resonance? Is it one representing the other? Is it understanding issues which were in the air, as it were, and represented differently? And how does one read Greek and classical sources with reference to what was happening elsewhere in the Indian Ocean? So the point then would be to see who built this tomb, who were the patrons, and who are the people who actually paid for it? And did they provide the choice? Was it their choice that this monster or these representations were shown on the railing pillars? The donors, there are inscriptions, there are several inscriptions on this, I don't have time to go into it, but the donors cut across a wide cross-section. They range from royals and monks and laymen to people who traveled from other parts of South Asia and did make this pilgrimage to the Buddhist site and offered their donations. Now there's another representation. One, we've seen this monster swallowing the boat. But there's another representation, which is a representation of the winged horse as a savior. And this starts occurring around the first, second centuries CE. And what is interesting is that this starts occurring at the time when the first inscriptions come up in Western India, which talk about various political dynasties controlling the ocean. Now, it's interesting that they say, we know that there is no there's no way they could have controlled this, but in their inscriptions, they talk about control of three oceans. Again, the sites that I'm talking about are sites inland, but before I go to that, the winged horse as a savior, this is from Mathura, is on the other side, but the story goes that there were these merchants who were shipwrecked. There was an ogress, and the ogress is on the bottom register, and she imprisoned these merchants in a tower, and the bodhisattva in the form of a white horse, he came and saved these merchants. Not all the merchants wanted to be saved, and they said they were having a good time where they were, and that the story that the ogress would devour them, they didn't sort of really believe in it. So the ones who wanted to be saved got onto this white horse, which flew up in the air, and so So some of the merchants got saved, not all of them. Again, this is a very a location which is in very far away from the seas. It's in North India on one of the rivers. But what is also significant is that this is a site. These are all the mounds. These arrows show all the mounds around the site of Mathura. Where that image came from is this mound, Bhuteshwar mound. But there's a large number of collections which were made, and I think the Ashmolean has a very beautiful Buddha hand of Buddha image, which comes from Mathura. How far did this winged horse go? Well, the winged horse story went a long way. Went all the way to Angkor and to Kampuchea, and the Buddhist temple shows this winged horse and the people hanging on. But this is the modern reincarnation, or showing the winged horse as the symbol of the international airport at Siem Reap. There's a third conceptualization of the savior, which is the Bodhisattva himself, who emerges as the savior. This representation comes slightly later, 5th to 9th centuries. And there are 8 dangers which the Bodhisattva is supposed to have saved his devotees from. One of those dangers is shipwreck. The others are, of course, very mundane, like chains, lions. Well, lions not so mundane, but snakes, elephants, and so on. But it's interesting that a shipwreck is one of the dangers that the Bodhisattva saves his devotees from. And this litany of the Bodhisattva being standing image of the Bodhisattva in the center, and the various dangers all around. Shipwreck is this one, where he saves his people who pray to him from being devoured or drowned in the ocean. The Bodhisattva images come from the west coast and from sites slightly inland, but really from the 5th century is when we start getting these rock-cut caves along the west coast, and this is one of the sites that has yielded the image which I showed you earlier. What is very clear is the maritime orientation of many of these Buddhist cave sites that were excavated in the ghats along this coast, and that's the site from where that Bodhisattva image, which I showed you, emerged. So, what is special about this period? What is it that led to all these images being sculpted? And the point I'm arguing is that we need to look at this within the larger context of what was happening in South Asia. Particularly in not merely through the eyes of the state or not merely through state control, but certainly there was increasing political power, there was increasing consolidation of localized chieftains, but we have a tremendous diversity of local coinage, extensive use of writing, and religious architecture. I think there's been much less work done on this aspect. And what is interesting is that there are several languages which are used, Sanskrit, Prakrit, Tamil, and Sinhala. This writing starts from writing on potsherds, so the writing is on pottery, and goes on to writing on a variety of objects, including on relic caskets, and we saw the relic caskets earlier. So I think this has enormous significance in terms of what was written, who was writing, the control of knowledge, and how this then spread across the ocean. And this is something which I think we need much more research on. I move to the second part of my, the issues that I talked about, and I'm going to look at this coast, which is the Andhra coast, or the southeast coast of India. This is the map of the Periplus, and the reason why I put this up is that you can see the blue dots all along, but there are no blue dots here. So it's odd. There are, Periplus doesn't talk about it. What does this mean, and how do we understand the Periplus? And the reason why it's important for me is to argue that we need to look at these in context and in the larger world of the Indian Ocean. Along the Andhra coast, as on the west, there is a series of Buddhist sites all along the coast, from there right up to here. I just want to show you two maps. One is the map indicating where Buddhist relics have been found, and the other indicating where Roman coins have been found. And I put this in to show the correspondence, that there does seem to be something very odd going on here, that the sites that have yielded relic caskets, there's also Roman coins that have been found there. There's a whole lot of the nearly 170 recorded finds of Roman coins, which are spread over 130 sites. But there's a concentration in the southeast coast, which I talked about. There's also a very strange absence of the finds of Roman coins, and the absence of these sites from the Periplus, which we need to understand. The Roman coins found in India, of course, are slashed. They are worn as ornaments. They are also used and appropriated in a variety of ways. They occur in relic deposits. So it's interesting that one of the early sites that was excavated on the Andhra coast, Patiprolu, has yielded coins, and this is also true of Northwest India, where coins are found in relic deposits. Coins also are found with images of deities, and this is, of course, a great coin to show the use of Greek on coin of a Kushana coin, which has the image of the Buddha on one side. So I would like to then end by raising questions that the Periplus, we have the Periplus, which all of us have worked with and all of us use, and it presents the Welkan Shaun from Alexandria, looking east. On the other hand, what I have shown and what interests me are the notions of the savior, depiction of this savior on monastic structures. Essentially, a very active engagement of the patrons and sponsors of Buddhist architecture with the sea. And this engagement is not just with coastal sites, but also sites further inland. So what does this mean, and how does one put this together? And in my own work earlier, I have argued about trade and Buddhism moving along with trade. I think we need to now move beyond that and start looking at the making of a religious and a cultural landscape, also looking at relic caskets, Buddha images, and other images that we get associated with religion and culture, looking at the context within which these have been found. But the larger question that I think we still haven't started asking is the question of the making of a cultural identity and how this cultural identity changed over time. Thank you very much.
Say that we'll save the questions for the very end, so we'll move on through the talks and then have time at the end before the reception for questions, so if you could bear that in mind. We'll press on then with the next talk, speaker already in place, I'm glad to say, and the other delightful thing, of course, is that for anyone sharing talks of this kind, the talk was bang on time for the first time, so we hope we can keep that going. Let me now introduce our next speaker, who is Professor Mark Horton. As you all know, he's Professor of Archaeology at the University of Bristol, and his research interests are very wide, focusing on historical archaeology, historical landscapes, maritime landscapes, long-distance trade and vocal responses, early spread of Islam and Christianity, archaeology and the media. He's undertaking research, excavations around the globe, and I won't list them all because it's global in nature, and his current research interests focus on East African coastal societies, Caribbean historical archaeology, industrial and historical archaeology. But this afternoon, he's going to focus on the prehistoric globalization of East Africa. Dr.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move on very rapidly, because we only have 20 minutes and I have a lot of material to cover. But you kindly mentioned my interest in industrial archaeology, so I suppose we should start off inevitably with the moment at which the Indian Ocean becomes modern, globalised in contemporary terms, which is when the cable is laid across between Aden and Bombay in 1870, and there is Brunel's great ship, the SS Great Eastern, lying at anchor in the bay. And including this picture makes one think what actually we mean by globalisation, what the modern historians would like us to have think, and the as well, modern evils of globalisation is maybe something slightly different to what we're going to be discussing in this conference over the next few days. But this image, and a similar one here, showing the telegraphs that were laid, shows that really what globalisation is all about is information. We understand the information world in which we now live, with the internet and so forth. And that in the 19th century, that information was being transferred by the telegraph. But in prehistory, that information was being transferred through maritime voyages and connections. And I think it is quite right that we can use the word globalisation, or proto-globalisation if you want to be purist, to try and understand how the Indian Ocean world connects with the places around the rim, and how information was transferred around these societies. And I'm going to particularly focus on East Africa, which has always been missed out in this discussion. Indeed, it's even missed out here in this museum. You go around crossing cultures, there's not a thing from Africa in any of these wonderful displays that are shown. And in some way, that's the missing story. And what we've been doing, particularly with Sea-Links, this is going to be a little bit of a publicity about Sea-Links, has been to try and put East Africa and South Africa into this global picture, if you like. It's a very relevant issue because Africa has always been seen as the victim of globalisation. It's Walter Rodney's famous title, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And you could possibly say How Asia Underdeveloped Africa. And this notion of the sort of the primitive Africa versus the developed Eurasian world. And what we try to do with this archaeology, with our archaeology, is try and redress that balance somewhat. A quick mnemonic, I hate lines, I like circles. What we're beginning to see is the process of globalization, if you like, which might have started in the Pacific, where we have the earliest evidence of extreme long-distance voyages, but perhaps shifting into the Indian Ocean world, and then finally, our modern globalisation with the Atlantic world. It's a nice little undergraduate mnemonic. But to give you some idea how we've fit into this wider emerging picture. And what I want to do is do two things. I first want to focus on globalisation in the first millennium of the Christian era, because that's where the archaeological evidence is becoming really quite clear and really interesting. This famous map, that if you don't know about it, you should do, it's just down the road in the Bodleian Library, and it is the most wonderful conceptualisation of what the Indian Ocean was thought in around 1000 AD. And you can see it traces around the rim, it's almost Bordelian in its conception. But what you've got, Mars marked it, is these islands. And I'm going to talk a bit about Pemba Island and Unguja, or Zanzibar Island, that you can see are very much more prominently located in this world map than their size would justify. And I would argue that they really are the key gateways in understanding the connections across the Indian Ocean. And by focusing on the archaeology of those islands, we can begin to understand how the region of East Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa was connected, because these islands act as the gateway into the continent. Thank God for Google Earth when you have to give lectures like this. But here the basic, the three islands I'm going to be talking about, Zanzibar Island, Pemba Island, and Mafia Island. And these are not little dots here, is where we've been undertaking SeaLink's projects over the last 3 years. You can count them up, they're quite industrious. And particularly targeting a particular way of looking at these sites by recovering properly stratified archaeological, archaeobotanical material, kind of micro-archaeology, rather than lay bare great lost cities. It's a much more incisive, much more scientific approach. And I'm certainly convinced by it. Somebody who laid bare lost cities early in my career, I think that this approach is very cost-effective and actually answers this kind of globalisation question that we want to discover. Okay, so the most important site you've probably haven't heard about is Ungujuqu, a wonderful, amazing place on the southern tip of Zanzibar, or southern part of Zanzibar, just here, which was investigated by myself in 1984, by Juma, Abdurrahman Juma in the 1980s, 1990s, and then we returned back in a SeaLinks project. And what we did was a typical SeaLinks type excavation, deep stratified excavation, beautiful zebra archaeology, and there's Anya at the bottom, breaking every health and safety rule in the book. But what it did do is give us a really good controlled archaeological sequence through the site, for which we could get a whole suite of radiocarbon dates, and also we can plot, for example, the occurrence of pottery at different times. And what was really surprising about this was the chronology. So this, for example, is a distribution of Chinese pottery that comes through this sequence. And you can see the Chinese pottery go practically down to the bottom here. And the radiocarbon dates, and I won't go into detail, but the radiocarbon dates place this in the early part of the 8th century or even the late part of the 7th century, depending on how you would like to calibrate. So what we have here is the presence of Chinese material, as well as Indian material, as well as Gulf material, present on this place in Zanzibar in the early part of the 8th century. And I can hear some a little bit of intake of breath, I think, in the back of the audience. But we must not forget that eventually this is part of a corridor. So Ungujuqu, which is located here, is part of a distribution of what we call Tana tradition, which is found right up in from southern Somalia and along the River Tana, all the way along the East African coast to the Comores and a little bit further south. And maybe one example in northern Madagascar. Particular characteristic wear, which is associated with the people living on this coast. And the earliest date we can get this back to is around the 6th century AD, something like that. But this is the point at which there is a global corridor, the East African corridor, which is connecting into this Indian Ocean world, and presumably within the East African coast. Sasanian Islamic, for example, is a nice example upstairs that some of us saw. Indian pottery, which is familiar to the Indianist amongst us. Glass beads, and the glass beads seem to have a connection to the Indo-Pacific beads, according to Marilee, who's somewhere in the audience, which would again tie us into the Indian world rather than necessarily the Persian Gulf world. The Chinese pottery is really interesting because from these early stratified levels, we've got olive green jars, these famous Doosan jars, that belong, that are well located, well dated to the early. Now, this is really far too early for the conventional wisdom. Chinese pottery appears in the Gulf places like Siraf in the middle or late part of the 8th century. So it raises a really interesting question. How is this Chinese pottery getting to these East African places? So see, there's a little Chinese mirror, for example. It's not just pottery, but other things you find associated with it. The well-known Belatan Rex site off the coast of Java, or Sumatra, which has these amazing collections of Changsha and of Doosan jars, which incidentally is made out of African timber. So we've got something happening, but maybe something that's rather different, which is connecting Southeast Asia with East Africa at this time. And if we, as it were, extend our gaze down from Zanzibar down to the Comores, where we've also been doing research recently, we can see that there's a much more Indonesian flavour to the archaeology of the Comores than we find on Zanzibar almost as if the Comores is really the place of contact, and Zanzibar is kind of the end of this trade route. So here we are, this is our excavations of the Comores, and this is the type of pottery you find sort of Tano-esque, but also these shell-impressed wares, which are not really found very often in that Tano assemblage, but seem to be much more associated with the Comore sites of the 8th century and maybe 9th. So, how does this fit? Do we actually have a different world in which we can see a connection from Southeast Asia following the edge of the Southeast trade winds across to the Comores, which are located here, and to Zanzibar Pemba, and then be returning back via South Asia? A southern route, how viable is that southern route? And this is a 19th century view where they actually knew about winds and currents in the Indian Ocean. You can see that essentially the line that route could well have taken from the Sunda Straits across to the Comores and Madagascar is perfectly viable. When they did a ship replica in the 1990s, it recorded an average of 133 nautical miles a day across this route, which would effectively mean it was within about 25 days from one side of the Indian Ocean. So it's perfectly viable once you've got the maritime technology that allows you to do it. So while most Indian Ocean archaeologists have concentrated on the north, the south is obviously a place of interest. Maybe the return, we found some evidence possibly here in our excavations in southern Sri Lanka in the spring at a site called Karinda on the extreme south coast. And here we have, in association in the 7th century, direct association of torpedo jars and also Dusan jars in the same level, also red polished ware as well, suggesting that there is maybe somehow in that southern Sri Lankan area a return route as you're returning back to Southeast Asia. So I think that the whole idea of a Southeast Asian connection into East Africa, feeding into that Tana-Swahili corridor, and obviously relevant understanding of the history and settlement of Madagascar, is something that we really need to consider. But I just want to finish with another interesting point, which is to look at prehistoric seafaring, to actually whether anything goes back into an earlier period. And here, the evidence comes from another of our excavations at Mafia Island, at Juani Primary School site, a site excavated by the brilliant archaeologist Felix Charmy from the University of Dar es Salaam, who has a wonderful nose of finding these places. And this is it, and we've got a nice sequence of Tano pottery at the top, but sealed into the classic early Iron Age Juani ware. That is the type fossil pottery of the early Bantu-speaking agricultural, maybe agricultural settlers of East Africa. But in this case, both Mafia Island is off the East African coast, they could only get there by boat, but secondly, it's a fully maritime culture, so you've got fish bones and shellfish and so forth. The people, these so-called Bantu agriculturalists, are actually a fully maritime culture at the Juani Primary School site. And it raises the question, how do they get there, and what are they up to? So this is the type of early Iron Age pottery that comes out of that excavation. And I've just been a bit wicked by doing this little graphic, which shows the classic assemblage from Kwale, which is up here in the Kwale Hills. There's our Mafia site here. And comparing it to the exactly contemporary early Iron Age pottery found in South Africa. This is 1 to 300 AD, which is typologically identical to the material found. So are we actually looking at a maritime connection? Now we actually have our early Iron Age culture in a maritime context on Mafia Island, and we have identical and contemporary material in the South African coast. Do we actually have a maritime connection between these two areas? What's really interesting is we might have, and I'd be very tentative about this, evidence of caprines on one of these, from Juani. And of course, one of the great mysteries has been the introduction of sheep into the Late Stone Age in South Africa. And again, is this part of this general process of the movement, which is undertaken by sea rather than overland? I'm being very heretical. What do they move in? Well, we actually probably know, because their boats are sitting on Lake Victoria, or Victorian Neanderthals, studied by James Hornell in the 1920s, and there's examples in the Kampala Museum today. These are sewn boats that are still being used on Lake Victoria today, and might well be part of this maritime culture. So, just to, as it were, to finish, we mentioned the Periplus, we'll get bored of the Periplus. 5 minutes. But I just want to cover essentially how that ties in with our understanding of the Periplus we all read, and are these early Iron Age agriculturalists living on Mafia the same people as mentioned in the Periplus? We have two sources. We have the Periplus itself that seems to describe a route down to most likely Pemba Island, this describing the way people play games with how to locate it down the East African coast, but it seems to be a very reliable, accurate description. But we also have a parallel document, almost identical date, Ptolemy's Geography, which has largely been ignored by historians and archaeologists. And this gives us, again, a very precise set of coordinates of these places. What's interesting is that Minuthias Island in Ptolemy's Geography, if you do a bit of fiddling around with the GIS and with the geo-referencing, is located at the top of northern Madagascar. So we see that same connection that we saw in the later Middle Iron Age, maybe going back to this period in the early Iron Age. And is this route part of essentially a late Stone Age society, or is it part of this early Iron Age society along the coast? And that is something that we don't yet understand. We've been excavating caves on Pemba and Zanzibar, which I'm sure we'll hear more about during this conference. And again, the evidence is a little ambiguous, but at the Bapangani cave in northern Pemba, we have an intriguing discovery of a large number of crocodile bones, and Manuthias is particularly noted as an island full of crocodiles, large crocodiles present today. So maybe this is the Periplus population, although the archaeology is a little ambiguous. At Kumbi Cave, the most famous of these sites on Zanzibar, excavated by Felix Charmy and Paul Sinclair, we think there's a relatively clear sequence in which we've got a pottery and lithics horizon with Tana pottery above this and a late Stone Age occupation from there. But the date of that late Stone Age, I think, remains ambiguous as to whether actually that crossing over to the island, or whether in fact it's a relic from when Zanzibar was connected to the mainland. And to finally, Henry Wright is here, but I thought I would draw attention to Henry Wright's and late Bob Dewar's extraordinary discovery with Chantel, who's also here, discovery at Anja Cave in northern Madagascar, where apparently we have late Stone Age occupation around 2,500 BC, and well dated from OSL dates, suggesting they have to have got there by boat, but they can't swim to northern Madagascar, and it was obviously not connected mainland. So we must maybe think of late Stone Age, or in old world times, Bronze Age seafarers who are moving up and down the East African coast. And if they are, then they are maybe connected into the emerging Bronze Age world of the Indian Ocean. And so I'd just like to finish really to say, don't forget Africa, because actually what we're talking about in Eurasia is as relevant to us Africanists. Thank you.
I'm delighted to have had East Africa introduced into the Ashmolean. We'll be here for 20 minutes to try our best to fill in the gaps. Our next speaker is really, of course, the person who's put this whole conference together, so deserves our great thanks indeed. It is Dr. Nicole Wauvin, who is Senior Research Fellow in Archaeology, Fellow at Jesus College here in Oxford. She has worked extensively in India for many years, studying particularly, of course, the prehistoric past of India, and this led her to really become interested in early connections with other continents. She's developed new excavation projects in other parts of the Indian Ocean, including Sri Lanka and East Africa, back again to that key area, and her current work explores the flow of goods, ideas, species, and people around the Indian Ocean, helping to demonstrate the high degrees of interconnectivity that preceded the Roman period. So, on that note, we invite her to talk about ancient biological exchange.
Shift gears a little bit from the previous two talks to focus on the biological world and, in particular, the relationship between expanding trade and exchange networks in the ancient world and the movement of biological species. And because we're in the Ashmolean Museum, I thought that I would draw on or kind of introduce an art historical dimension into this by drawing on works of ancient art displayed at various sites and museums, including the Ashmolean Museum. Now, one of the key questions that this conference is interested in addressing is exactly how globalized was the ancient world. And this is something that I'm not going to say a lot about directly, except to mention that there's an increasing sense that while the speed of communication and travel today and the degree of economic integration are, of course, greatly exceeding anything that we saw in the past, we actually live in a world that has long been globalizing. As the previous talks have made clear, and also, of course, a range of academic publications. But this scholarly view doesn't necessarily make it through into popular media and culture, nor does it even necessarily filter into other disciplines. And so the dominant view remains that globalization is essentially a very contemporary, a very novel phenomenon. And linked to the collapse of age-old barriers to communication and travel and economic integration is the breakdown of barriers to the movement of biological species, which are free then to move beyond their native range. And this biological globalization is widely seen as a costly and dangerous corollary of living in our overconnected modern world. And this is seen in both the academic literature and also in the popular media. And yet we know as archaeologists, as historians, as molecular geneticists, that biological exchange happened in the ancient world. And indeed, if we add it all up, it's very clear that it happened on a pretty substantial scale. Now, what kind of species moved around the ancient world? These are some of the categories here. Obviously, people, crops, domesticated animals, but also a number of categories which include species that today we would call invasive species, many of them, as well as a number of nasty diseases and such. And while we know a reasonable amount about the first three classes of species, we know far less about all of the other ones, although new methods like molecular genetics, ancient DNA work are starting to shed more light on this. Why did these species move around? Well, for a whole range of reasons, from the esoteric, from the kind of practical and mundane through to the esoteric and ritual, and also many species were moved around kind of unintentionally. And so what I'm going to do is to explore the stages of what we might call proto-globalization and give some examples of species translocations. And I'm not going to try in this short time that I have to give a comprehensive account. And indeed, because much of the archaeological evidence focuses on the West, I'm going to be focusing in particular on evidence from that region. Okay, so the first kind of baby steps towards globalization took place in the Bronze Age, a time period where we see the first cities and large-scale trade networks emerge. And one example of a region where we see these kind of trade networks emerging is this one here, where trade, both kind of terrestrial and maritime routes, began to link up a large region from Arabia all the way across Mesopotamia and the Iranian plateau through to South Asia. Now, initially, this trade was focused very much on luxury items, on things like ivory combs and precious and semi-precious stones from India that would move into the Persian Gulf. But through time, and by the end of the 3rd millennium BC, this trade had started to include more practical items. So we see in textual evidence that foodstuffs and wood coming from South Asia into the Persian Gulf are moving around. And this imagery doesn't all necessarily relate to this time period. The evidence is mostly textual. And so moving also along these trade networks are various biological species, and these included live exotic plants and animals, which were much sought after in the ancient world, for example, as tribute offerings or expressions of royal prestige. And we have nice pictorial evidence of this in a pharaoh's tomb of the mid-second millennium BC in Egypt, which records a voyage to the land of Punt, which is somewhere to the south, and which brought back a number of exotic goods and also some species, and which nicely records the transplantation of incense trees into Egyptian soil. Domesticated plants and animals also spread via both maritime and terrestrial routes during the Bronze Age. Zebu cattle, for example, from South Asia, with this distinctive hump on the neck that you see, they spread from South Asia by trade routes into Mesopotamia, into the Arabian Peninsula, and also by about 2000 BC they get to Africa. And Africa, in exchange, gives at least 5 domesticated crops to India around this same time period, including sorghum. And we know very, very little other than that these exchanges took place. We don't have a good sense from archaeological or historical records of exactly what was going on. And these are just a range of different long-distance plant translocations that happened in the ancient world by both maritime routes and also, for example, along the Proto-Silk Road. But it's not just intentional translocations that are happening. There's a very nice example from the late Bronze Age in the Mediterranean Sea of a shipwreck that went down off the southeast coast of Turkey in sometime in the late 14th century BC. This ship was laden with all sorts of amazing material goods, but also had beautifully preserved botanical remains that had been analyzed, and the archaeobotanists have been able to identify literally dozens and dozens of different plants, including a range of weed species that today would be classified as invasive species, as well as a number of commensal hitchhikers. So at least one domestic mouse is found on board the ship, and a number of land snails, and the locations of those land snails are indicated by the numbers at the bottom. But it's very clear that despite this finding of the house mouse, at this point in time, the house mouse is expanding into the Mediterranean. It's not colonizing the Mediterranean until the Iron Age. And so we have a sense that although there are these trade networks, that they are much more limited and irregular than they'll become in a later time period. So in the mid-first millennium BC, we take a big step further towards globalization. And in the West, this takes the form of increased contact between the Hellenistic world and South Asia. And the results of this are a gradual but constant trickle of species, particularly westwards from South Asia, but also in the other direction. And botanical products were a primary focus of Hellenistic trade with India, particularly Asian spices, which are burnt and incense burners like this, but also other cultivated plants are translocated and become established in new areas, crops like rice, cucumbers, citrons, and coriander, and various animals as well. So you can see the chicken up there, and that's an exotic introduction into the Mediterranean around this time period. And there are a whole variety of other exotic bird transfers, and also the cat is translocated to Greece from Egypt by the 5th century BC. And it may be that cats are brought in to deal with this growing mouse problem, because now the mouse has truly exploded across the Mediterranean. But the point at which we see trade networks really consolidating across a large area is in the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD, and probably relates in large part to the consolidation of political power across vast areas as part of the emergence of the Roman Empire and the Chinese Han Dynasty Empire. And critical to this increasing integration was the improvement of transport infrastructure and technology, and the emergence also of new trade routes. So, for example, we start to see the much more regular use of this trade route that links up the Red Sea to South India and leads to the exchange of vast quantities of Roman gold for black pepper. But it's not just these kind of more valuable exotic goods that are moving around. The Periplus makes clear that there are a whole range of just kind of everyday goods that move around. And maybe they're not moving quite as far, but they're part of these very increasingly intense networks that are connecting up the Indian Ocean. And so the result of this increase was naturally a significant increase in the flow of biological species. And so in Europe, there's evidence both for the arrival of a number of new species, but also reintroductions of species that were there previously but were rare and exotic. So we have evidence for the further spread of the domestic chicken and the black rat, finds of which increased substantially on archaeological sites of the Roman period. And these are a range of small mammal translocations around and into the Mediterranean Sea, and a great number of these relate to the Roman period. We shouldn't assume that they're all unintentional translocations, although probably a number are, but things like the garden dormouse were considered a delicacy by the Romans and were deliberately translocated to new areas for consumption. And related to the spread of things like black rat was the spread of diseases, and bubonic plague in particular was introduced probably around this time period and fully erupted into a major epidemic by the end of this period, by the mid-5th century AD. And molecular genetics is very nicely demonstrating that this was the result of that the bubonic plague was the result of multiple dispersals of this disease out of East Asia. And it's even beautifully starting to highlight the linkage between particular strains of this disease and trade routes across the Silk Road. In terms of domestic species, along with the chicken, both the Greek and the Romans introduced new breeds and diversified traditional breeds through various animals brought in from all around, from as far away as India. But alongside these domestic and commensal species, there was a substantial flow of exotic wild species into the Mediterranean world for various purposes, including slaughter in amphitheater events, which could go on for days and involve the slaughter of thousands and thousands of animals. And the Romans really turned this. This had been going on, this trade in wild animals, for a long time, but the Romans really turned it into a systematic business. And in a number of cases, this led to reductions in biodiversity in source areas. Crops were also translocated on a very substantial scale. So in England, where we have some of the best archaeobotanical evidence, it's clear that at least 50 new crops were introduced during the Roman period, many of these entering into cultivation. Okay, so here I get to the medieval world, and I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go very quickly through the medieval world, but I want to make the point that we have a very Eurocentric view of the medieval period. Nothing much happens there. A lot actually goes on in the medieval period in the Indian Ocean. In fact, the Indian Ocean is thronged with more ships than ever before, increasingly intensive trade, and linked to these changes is another surge of species translocations. And Andrew Watson, some decades ago, described the impact of a range of new crop dispersals during this period on agriculture. People weren't entirely sure whether to believe him, but archaeology and archaeobotanical work is starting to back this up very nicely in places like Egypt. In East Africa, where we are working, we see a whole range of different species moving into Africa from all around the Indian Ocean, and our work is increasingly suggesting that these are primarily happening in the medieval period. And then, as in previous periods, exotic wild animals also continue to be transported around the Old World, and wild cats, in particular cheetahs, were used by the elite in various parts of the world as trained hunting animals, and they were primarily transported by sea routes across the Indian Ocean. And a Mongol Khan would apparently take something like 1,000 cheetahs on a great hunt. So this was a trade on, again, a very substantial scale. Okay, so while I've really only been able to provide examples rather than a comprehensive overview, I hope you get a sense that biological exchange was happening in the Old World, and it was happening on a pretty substantial scale. And we have evidence for the creation across the Old World of highly cosmopolitan assemblages of organisms that resulted from layer upon layer of exchange. Now, are those species translocations a bad thing? Well, in some cases, certainly yes, they led to the spread in certain cases of some very nasty diseases that wiped out thousands and thousands of people. They led to the spread of some very nasty invasive species like the black rat that had serious impacts in a number of environments that they ended up in. There's nonetheless evidence to suggest that we're also healthier and live in more biodiverse environments because of, rather than despite, these movements. The world that we live in and are trying to conserve is in part a legacy of the incredible efforts that our ancestors went to change species distributions globally. Now, I'm not saying that we don't worry about species translocations and, you know, invasive species, whatever, let's stop worrying about that. But I am saying that there is a much more complex story here, and that we need to look critically at species translocations and their histories and experiences. explore what they mean, and we should not assume that non-native species are necessarily bad or that human impact is always negative, and that's what these studies are starting really to show. And I wanted to just end with this map showing biodiversity hotspots around the world, and I wanted to note that they are very heavily concentrated around the Indian Ocean Rim in places that those of us who study this region will recognize as having been in contact with other regions over thousands of years, having seen major biological translocations, and yet they're places of great biodiversity. Now, is this despite all of the trade and exchange that we saw, or does that also reflect that something perhaps more interesting was happening? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so to our last speaker for this afternoon, Dr. J.T. Hill. He oversees the strategic direction, management and funding of research activities across the British Museum. So he did write that, and he obviously has knowledge of the dark arts, as we all want in terms of that information. He also works broadly across the museums in projects. My favourite one was attached to his door when he was the head of the history of the world, which is a title very few of us can ever come into. And interestingly, he's also responsible for the museum's human remains. He's an expert, as we know, in Iron Age Britain, but he has very strong research interests in maritime archaeology and indeed in the Indian Ocean histories. And this afternoon, he's going to talk about lessons from the past and for the future of the Indian Ocean.
Thank you very much. I thought I might start because I thought Nicole might be wanting to think about having a holiday. What I want to talk about today is something quite different from the talks you've already had. I want to spend some time to reflect on what might be the relationships between the work which archaeologists and deep historians do on the Indian Ocean and what people today are thinking about in terms of the current challenges which face this large open region. And I thought I'd start here because if you Google Indian Ocean through Google UK, one of the top searches comes up is Indian Ocean holidays. So for large numbers of certainly the British public, the Indian Ocean is now associated with a place for you to go on holidays, and as it says here, a perfect mother and daughter trip. It's also, of course, this is the vision, the romantic vision of the Indian Ocean, of white sandy beaches, usually with a picture of some form of archaic dhow in the background, at the end of Mark's talk, which we see quite a lot when we go to discussions about the Indian Ocean. While this is one view of what the Indian Ocean of the 21st century looks like, for those of us who've been to other parts of the Indian Ocean, or live in other parts of the Indian Ocean, Mumbai, Port Hedland in Western Australia, for example, this is a very different view of what the modern Indian Ocean is. And I think it's trying to think about what the relationship is between Indian Ocean's past and this present nature of the Indian Ocean, which is what I want to concentrate on. But I want to start this exploration with a story. This is a blue and white Chinese potsherd in the British Museum's collection. Most museums, including this museum, one of the public functions of the museum is that there are places where people can bring objects, anyone can bring an object to actually have it identified. And a very long time ago now, probably 10, 12 years ago, I was the duty curator. Paul will remember what it's like to be a duty curator at the British Museum. And a young South Asian British couple arrived at the doors of the British Prehistory Department with a bag full of shirts. They'd been sent to the wrong department. They should have been sent to East Asia, but they ended up with me, a British prehistorian, to tell them what they were. We went through these shirts. Most of them were pieces of willow patternware, 19th century statuary products. But within this bag of shirts, there are a number of shirts which look remarkably similar to this. Chinese pieces of blue and white porcelain. The afternoon unfolded. They told me more about how they came upon these shirts. They belonged to one of their grandmothers. She had picked it up as a child on the beach in Mombasa. I told them more about this being Chinese pottery and introduced them to the histories of the Indian Ocean, how this pottery may have got there, because now I would also be able to tell them about hairy bananas. I failed to mention hairy bananas. Anyone who comes to a CELIX conference learns about banana genetics, and hairy bananas is something you stick in the mind. A conversation unfolded. They tell me about their family's history. Her mother, their grandmother's mother, had become, as India, as a wife to someone who had arrived in Kenya and Tanzania as an indentured labourer to work on the railways. They then had to flee East Africa. They had ended up in Uganda in the 1970s and arrived in West London. And one of the few things this family brought with them was a bag full of pot shirts, which their grandmother had picked up on the beach. They told me one story of the recent Indian Ocean. I told them another story which set that pot shirt and that family's history into a much bigger framework going back several thousand years, a history of trade, a history of connections, a history of CELIX. This conversation around an object is, of course, what museums are here to do. I want a conversation about the past and the present, about two different people with very different interests, very different specialisms about the Indian Ocean, is perhaps something we should think about as a model to talk about how the relation, what is the relationship between the history and archaeology of this region and the present day challenges it faces. And it's part of a much wider notion. First speaker talked about mobile objects as what Elizabeth Lambour described as the Indian Ocean as an ocean of objects, a term which of course any museum curator is going to love. Objects provide one way to explore these CELIX, explore this history of connections, provide one way to start a series of conversations between past and present, between different peoples around the Indian Ocean. But what I want to reflect on for most of this talk is both the benefits of talking about a connected Indian Ocean's history, but also potentially some of its dangers. Now, the CELIX project, which we're here to celebrate, has been remarkable in terms of where it has added to our rich understanding of the histories of these connections. Now, I certainly know more about the deep history. How long have these connections been going onwards? Now back into the Bronze Age, 5,000 years ago. But also how different types of objects, different types of things can tell histories of connections. It's the dispersal of animals and plants, which the last talk has just discussed, which has been one of the key sort of things I've taken away from coming from CELIX meetings. That it's not just blue and white pot shirts, pieces of other pottery that we can build these histories of connections around and on. A question about this type of deep connection is, well, what does it really mean for the Indian Ocean now? Again, Google Indian Ocean and Google UK, and if you don't find out about holidays, you find out about piracy. We have many colleagues in our universities around this country and the world who now run courses about piracy. The Indian Ocean, for many people in the West, for many people who work in businesses in London, is a problem. A problem because of piracy is interrupting the flow of trade. And because this is not, it's not piracy that matters, which typifies the Indian Ocean, it is what is behind piracy and what piracy interrupts for the businessmen and the politicians of the 21st century. This is a map of modern sea traffic. Lines on maps. We see lots of lines on maps at Indian Ocean history conferences. This shows the flow of trade around the Indian Ocean. Some estimates suggest that as much as 70% of the world's sea trade passes through one part of the Indian Ocean every year. It has become, for the economists and the politicians, an area of tremendous strategic importance. And just to emphasise that is, if you start to look at the number of the world's busiest ports, outside of China and outside of Antwerp, these are now increasingly around the Indian Ocean. The little picture at the bottom, for those of you who've never been there, and I still haven't yet, is a place called Port Hedland. I've still not been there. I knew nothing about it until 3 years ago, until I started going to Western Australia. It's the world's busiest port for bulk raw materials. busiest port in the world. And it is this concentration of global trade now which is what concentrates the mind of politicians and businessmen and others. But it's not just trade. While the Indian Ocean remains the principal route through which oil, raw materials and manufactured goods passes around the old world, it's an area which has a whole series of other strategic priorities. Here are a few factoids. I'm sure if we check these, then we might find things wrong with them. But most of these are taken from the United Nations, so I'm hoping they've got most of them right. Not only is this a place for 70% of the world's trade, this is the place where the major world's oil reserves are still held. Now, someone told me a couple of weeks ago that 40% of the offshore oil industry is now centred around the coasts of East Africa, West Africa and different parts of Southeast Asia. It's the place where roughly 40% of the world's population lives, but it's also a place of tremendous political conflict and political importance. I'm not sure how you count political conflicts. One United Nations agency says there were 388 in 2011, and 142 of those were in the Indian Ocean region. This is the reality for the Indian Ocean for lots of people, not everyone who lives in the Indian Ocean, but for many people, particularly in government, particularly in business, this is what reflects their interests. And it's from this interest that you see a whole range of increasing governmental and economic interest in the Indian Ocean. In June this year, the Chinese government finally published its 350-page Indian Ocean strategy, a blue book which will dictate what China's policy for the region well is. Whereas in Pentagon in North America, military officials worry about the end of American supremacy and how this is playing out in the Indian Ocean. Pentagon officials who, by the way, quote archaeology and Indian Ocean history. Much of the strategic discussion in the Indian Ocean almost certainly mentions this man's travels around the Indian Ocean, but also generally talks about the Indian Ocean as always being an interconnected place. And this, I think, brings up an interesting challenge for those of us who work in museums. If you take you back to that story I told you about my discussion with that South Asian family, what surprised them was connection. What surprised many people today is the fact that the world was connected to such a degree in the distant and recent past. There is a general assumption that the world was not connected, as we've heard, before the 18th or 19th century in this way. And in a sense, this is used because it is seen as an exception. But you've just heard Mark tell us that in fact there are Chinese ceramics in East Africa as early as the 8th century. This voyage is not necessarily an exception, it's part of a very, very long engagement by China and Chinese people with the Indian Ocean region stretching back hundreds of years. So on the one hand, to tell people and remind people that the Indian Ocean world has been connected, and connected in surprisingly diverse and sophisticated ways, for at least 2,000 years, maybe 5,000 years, who knows, we'll probably push the dates back even further soon, is something which is extremely important to remind people, because it does provide our perspective from which to think about the nature of these connections in the present day. And certainly when you talk to politicians and businessmen about the Indian Ocean, this sense of connection, this sense of deep past is something which they find appealing, because it does provide them with a sense of why the Indian Ocean is the way it is now. Because that's not just about connection to trade, that explains the ethnic and religious network which actually typifies this region now. But there are dangers with this sense of deep connection. Here are two blue and white objects made in China that cross the Indian Ocean. This is where I'm going to disagree with the previous speakers. The economic and political conditions in which that South Asian family's grandfathers moved to India as indentured labour is not the same as the social and political conditions in which Indians traded with East Africa in the 13th century. They are different things. In just the same way that while on the one hand the talk about the relationships between the Gulf and India now stretching back 5,000 or 6,000 years provides a perspective on the modern relationships between the golf in India, it in no way excuses or explains the treatment of South Asian migrant workers in those regions. There are dangers with deep connection. They provide a comfort, they provide a way of saying this has always happened, therefore particular things which are happening now are somehow more acceptable. So there is a danger here in thinking about connection. And I think there's a danger here, potentially, in the word, using these words, connection. The Indian Ocean has always been connected, yes. The Indian Ocean has always been connected to a way and a degree unlike any other body of water, perhaps even the Mediterranean, right, when I run away when I say that. But this is not the same as that. For me, call me an old-fashioned Marxist, but globalisation isn't about a particular scale of the flow of information around the world. It's about a particular combination of social and economic and political factors which determine the way the world economic system is now. And this is unique to the late 20th and 21st century and throws up a unique series of relationships. And that has a particular cultural manifestation. This is an object in the British Museum. Because of that object, we felt actually says something rather particular and distinct about the nature of globalised culture in the 21st century. It says something which is unique and different to the way that talks about globalisation, proto-globalisation, if you want to call that, or connections in the 14th and 15th century, but these are very different economic situations, these are very different cultural situations in the way in which these objects work. They're both about a connected Indian Ocean, but they're both about a very different Indian Ocean. And that, I think, moves on to some other bigger issues, perhaps, for us to think about. Indian Ocean is always connected. We can talk more about what this form of connection actually means, but are there more dimensions to a historical perspective of the Indian Ocean to provide the world today? I personally think there is. Now, for me, as a global historian, as a curator of world history, the reason I'm interested in seas and oceans is that they provide a way of getting away from national histories, terrestrial histories. The blue blank bit on the map, you know, provides a different way of focusing our attention to a part of the world which perhaps, and only perhaps, enables us to escape from national or regional histories. This is, you know, a map of the Indian Ocean where all the blue bits have been turned green and black, brown, to make the point that what a perspective-changing version an ocean history is about. Ocean histories are not simply about histories of connection. I disagree with Wenck and Eliot. What an ocean perspective allows you to do is to treat that as a unit of analysis, to compare and contrast social, economic, and cultural processes, to ask questions about why things are happening at the same time in different parts of that region, but also ask questions about why they're not happening at the same time. And just remember, an archaeology of an Indian Ocean which is all about connections makes our Australian colleagues feel very sad and left out. There are parts of this Indian Ocean world which do not necessarily have to be connected, but they're still part of an Indian Ocean perspective. They are still something which we can talk about in terms of the history of this region. But also turning back to these different histories of the sea is to ask some very pertinent questions for the Indian Ocean region today. Now, where is the ocean in this? There's a lot about connection. We always see, you know, we haven't heard about the monsoon tonight, actually. Usually, when we have a meeting about the Indian Ocean, we always have a little bit about the monsoon. That enables us to say we've considered oceanography and currents a little bit, but actually, that's enough. No, there's a lot more to the Indian Ocean than this. Yeah. And there are big areas missing in our understanding of the Indian Ocean. We know very little, really, about ships and seafaring, surprisingly, considering how much we know about connections. But there are other types of histories which we need to perhaps consider. This slide just shows you a snapshot of what's happening around the Indian Ocean in terms of fishing and aquaculture. This is a startling fact I found out last week. 40% of the people engaged and employed in fishing in the world live and work around the eastern half of the Indian Ocean, not even the western half of the Indian Ocean. We have huge amounts of agriculture, fish shrimp farming activities, seafood farming activities. Mangrove destruction is becoming a major issue around the Indian Ocean. Overfishing is becoming a major issue, as of course is sea level rise. And again, the majority of the countries who will be most affected by sea level rise are in the Indian Ocean region. Where are our historical perspectives to help us understand and set this type of issue of the Indian Ocean? These are not necessarily histories of connection, but they're environmental and natural histories. And again, thinking about connection, Google the Indian Ocean, this is the number one hit. And if you want to think about the way in which the Indian Ocean and the peoples around the Indian Ocean are connected in different ways and connected through the sea, then the impact of the Boxing Day tsunami provides a very good way of making people understand it. These are not to say histories of connection are wrong. These are not to say history of connections are the only ones we can't have. But it's to suggest that there are other histories and other stories that we can tell. And as I said, what I take away from Seedlings is the way in which it's integrated in a far more successful way than I've seen in any other history and archaeological project, studies of plants and animals and plants and animals' DNA within these bigger historical questions. And that, I think, provides a very interesting model for the future. And so let me finish by telling you another story. I was on a boat in the Indian Ocean a couple of weeks ago, and I met two people. And one of these people told me about the fact that they had bought an object decorated with cowrie shells in West Africa and said, are they the same cowrie shells as we just saw on our last scuba dive? And the marine biologist who was also in the boat said yes. But from then started another set of stories. The stories which the person who'd been to West Africa learnt about the fact that the reason why we have cowries in Indian Ocean carriers in West Africa is part of that long history of the slave trade. We learn a lot about the ecologies of cowries and what's happening to the ecologies of cowries with climate change, and I was able to sort of butt in little bits about the role of cowries as money. Another conversation between other people about an Indian Ocean prompted by an Indian Ocean object, but a very different set of stories. Yes, they're about connections, but they're about other things other than connections. And unfortunately, there isn't time now to tell you why Mungo Park carries cowries under his head. They're part of an Indian Ocean story, but they'll have to wait for another time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that extraordinary, exciting range of talks, which I think give a good indication of how exciting the next 3 days are going to be at that level of interest. The remarkable thing is that we are actually ahead of schedule. And so there is plenty of time for some questions now before those of you who have registered for the conference can indulge in the conference reception. So we've got about 10 minutes, so if there are any questions that have arisen over the last hour and a half or so, then you can direct them to the speakers. Nothing.
Good.
Which means we can head straight upstairs. Yes, sir.
Sorry for the bizarre nature of the question, but Barry was talking about something related to globalization earlier in Toyo. Do we all agree about what this is? Is this early? Is this proto? Or are these just clouds that are passing through and we all agree that they're clouds?
So at what point do we move from proto to full globalization? Mm-hmm. Is that, who would like to tackle that one?
Or is it even a relevant question?
I mean, it's a very relevant question. The term proto-globalization is a useful term in trying to talk about these processes to wider audiences. It helps them get a sense that actually that there is something similar, potentially, about what's going on in the world now in terms of the interactions and the level of exchanges with what's going on in the past. I think where we will have disagreements about is,
Can I disagree with JD at this point? I suggest that actually the word proto is a bit of a weasel word, really. And with the, as it were, perspective of history, if we look back in 500 years hence, we won't see necessarily our globalisation moments as actually significantly different to that of the Islamic world, or the Greek world, or the Bronze Age world. The scale is different, but essentially it's the same basic idea of undermining it. So I would remove the word proto myself and just use the word globalisation and let JD have this very Eurocentric view of the world.
This is not a time to have a long discussion about globalisation in the 21st century. Globalisation in the 21st century is not Eurocentric. It's about a particular combination of social and political and economic forces which typify the world now. And I would disagree with you, as someone who works with objects, in saying that the material objects which relate to connections now are actually of a different nature and have a different set of circumstances and context around them than the ones you want to talk about for 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. But we're never going to recover.
Interesting to make a difference between what we call a sphere of interaction and a
debate will move forward. Okay. Any other questions or comments?
I have a question from Matt Holden. My question is about the travel and the surf of Indian Ocean. And he said that the travel will be 25 days.
Yes.
And I was thinking, like, to have on the boat 25 days of water and food. And I was thinking, when do you think that could begin? What would be the first day that you would begin?
Well, what you're saying is 25 days on the boat possible?
When it begin possible?
Well, presumably it's once you can carry sufficient water. So we can get back to shapes of pots if you want. That's, you know, boats with sufficient size and boats contain sufficient quantities of water to do that. What I'm really arguing is that really the first evidence for this, I think, is in the first millennium, later part of the first millennium AD, and not amazingly earlier, that many people have argued. But the archaeological evidence might in the future contradict it. But certainly by 700 AD, there is a technology in Southeast Asia that makes this not just possible, but possible on a regular and sustained basis. I'm sure Pierre will agree. Yes? He's done the boats up.
Time for one more question, I think, if there are any. No? Well, having spent the 10 minutes debating whether we should have called the conference something else other than globalisation, it's probably a good moment to draw to a close. I'd say, for those of you who have registered for the conference, there is now a reception upstairs in the Ashmolean's Mallet Gallery. Members of staff will be outside to direct you up the stairs. Thank you very much indeed.